The Heal Podcast has been created to explore my favorite ingredients for a long-term, sustainable, healthy human experience. We take an informed look into topics that include nutritional and emotional well-being, as well as expanding consciousness. Heal stands for Healthy Eating and Living, so why not sit back, relax, be present, and enjoy the conversations about this unique gift we were all given, called life. If you feel this podcast has resonated with you, please feel free to share it with your friends, family, and colleagues, as the gift of knowledge is something wondrous. Thank you for your open hearts and minds. Alrighty, let's get into some delicious healing. If you would like to become a qualified health coach, then the Institute for Integrative Nutrition, or IIN for short, can help you achieve your goals. I completed their health coaching course many years ago, which has been one of the catalysts for my own journey into what I now love to do, which is to help people achieve greater health through the sharing of information through my books, seminars, podcasts, TV shows, and films. I recommend IIN for anyone wishing to pursue a career in the health coaching and wellness space. IIN is a one-year course, so that if you're a full-time worker, busy parent, or wherever you are in your life, it is flexible enough so you'll be able to complete all the required curriculum. Please see the link included in the podcast show notes or my website to access the free sample class and first module of their program. This will give you a great taste of the format as well as the structure, and you can also utilize my special discount that I can offer you if you decide to sign up. Make sure you tell the admissions team that you're part of the Pete Evans Tuition Savings to claim your very substantial discount. Please visit integrativenutrition.com or email admissions@integrativenutrition.com. Charles Eisenstein was born in 1967. He is a public speaker, gift economy advocate, and the author of several books, including The Ascent of Humanity, Sacred Economics, The More Beautiful World Our Hearts Know Is Possible, and Climate, A New Story. Born in 1967, Eisenstein graduated from Yale University in 1989 with a degree in mathematics and philosophy. He's lived in Taiwan, where he worked as a translator. He married, had children, and later returned to the United States. Charles now frequently travels to speak and share his work at conferences and other events. Since 2010, he has spoken over 300 times in over 100 cities in the US and elsewhere. His events are held voluntarily, organized by others who invite him to speak. He generally charges people expenses, but no fee, leaving it up to them to give him something if they feel the urge. This appeals to his ideal of generosity and living in the gift. To find out more about Charles, please visit his website, charleseisenstein.org. That is charleseisenstein.org. Charles, thank you so much for being on the podcast today. How are you?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Mate, fantastic. Just had a beautiful cup of tea with my wife to start the day, and the sun is up. And I know on the other side of the world where you are, the sun is actually starting to set.
Yep, that's right.
Mate, I just want to take this time to thank you for all that you're doing for the conscious awakening of the planet and putting it out there that it is okay to have hope. I've read your book and watched a lot of the talks that you've done, and you have a very unique perspective and different perspective that I'm attracted to and so many people are attracted to. And I'd love to understand how you came to be who you are and what it is that you feel compelled to express and to share and to learn and to study and then to teach people what it is that your intention is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, thank you for that question. In fact, my background and my life history is not that extraordinary. I don't have any miracle stories or heroic journeys to recount. But I can say that, like many people, I grew up thinking that it's not supposed to be this way and wondering what the source of the wrongness is and why everybody around me thinks it's normal to hate Monday and to look forward to Friday. And to hate school, which is supposed to be preparation for life. And I just couldn't accept that this is normal. And it wasn't only a feeling of despair at being locked in a prison planet, so to speak, but also a feeling that not only is it not supposed to be this way, but it doesn't have to be this way, that there's a more beautiful world that's possible and that we can create, that's within our power to create. And our doesn't just mean this abstract us, but in some paradoxical way, depends on my own agency. And when I was young, I couldn't have articulated it in that way, but there was some thread to that future that kept me on this path and that has blossomed into the kind of things that I'm doing today. Does that make sense?
It definitely does. And I've got a list of words written on my notes here and instead of proper questions, because I feel like sometimes we have this wonderful flow that we can get into. Old normal is something that really popped out when I was reading your book. And I'd love for you to be able to explain what that means, the old normal, because you're wanting to usher in and promote a new uncommon, possibly.
Yeah. The phrase old normal is a resonant phrase, because even without explaining it, people kind of know what you're talking about. I phrase it in terms of a story that tells us what the world is and what a life looks like and how to be a man or a woman, how to be a human also, and what's important in life and how things work and why we're here and who we are. Like, all of that is encoded in a mostly unconscious story. And it's not just a story, it's also a set of experiences that define normal. So you disobey your parents and you get yelled at. Okay, that's normal. You play hooky from school and you get in trouble. Okay, that's normal. All these experiences that we have define the limits of our world and also restrict our understanding of what's possible and who we are. And so we get locked down into these smaller selves that were, in a way, appropriate and necessary for a certain phase of human evolution or collective evolution, the evolution of the dominant civilization on Earth. We had to fit into the roles that that civilization required. But as that civilization itself is undergoing a metamorphosis, the people who we had to be to fit there are no longer appropriate or compelling. And so many, many people now are yearning for a new normal, which is not only a new story that says who you are and why you're here, but also for a new set of reinforcing circumstances that can help us inhabit an unfamiliar self. And so I can go on and on, but you know, we get these glimpses of what the world could be, what relationship could be, what school could be, what healing could be, who we could be. And they feel like such a powerful promise or even a homecoming. But then maybe after a few hours or a few days or a few weeks, then the reinforcing external circumstances pull us back into who we had been, and the internal habits and the unhealed wounds pull us back into who we had been. And maybe we wonder, are we crazy? You know, did that actually even happen? Did I really experience that? Which is why we need to come together and have, you know, podcasts like this, where we can name, yeah, this is what happened, and you're not crazy, and I saw it too.
What you talk about is that the world that we currently live in, it should be, by all intents and purposes, be evolving in a positive way. But what we're finding is, you know, politically, we're at the worst possible time that we've ever had. In a health realm, we have all these amazing advances in modern medicine, but as a population, we're sicker than we've ever been. As far as education, we know more than we've ever known, yet our education system seems to be broken to the point where kids are just, you know, stressed out learning information that has no bearing whatsoever to the general part on their lives. The big question is, how did we get to where we are right now? And on the flip side, people say, actually, no, this is actually the best time that we've ever been alive. Mm-hmm. Is it a paradox?
Well, that is a big question. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure if I could say that politically it's the worst that it's ever been compared to, say, 1939 or something.
True.
Or necessarily that we're sicker than we've ever been compared to the Black Death, the plagues and things. But but for sure, we are not happier and healthier than we were 20, well, let's say two generations ago, one to two generations ago. And people like Steven Pinker point out, they make an argument that we are better and better off. There are fewer people in poverty, violent deaths are lower, life expectancy is higher, literacy rates are higher, et cetera, et cetera. You could pick other statistics, though, the number of suicides per capita going up and up and up, the rate of opioid addiction and other addiction, the rate of depression, anxiety, psychological disorders. These are not hallmarks of a happy population. And not to mention ecological degradation. I have kids, you know, and a couple of little incidents, I think, help paint this picture. One was I had to send in the health forms to the school. And the school, for some reason, I didn't do it. And the school nurse called, you know, and she said, well, okay, you send them in, but right now I need to know what medications is he on and what is he allergic to? And I'm like, no medications, and he's not allergic to anything. Mm-hmm. And she could hardly believe it because that is an exception now. Whereas when I was a kid, there might be like one or two kids in the whole school who were allergic to something. But now it's so commonplace that it's non-normal to be completely healthy. And then another thing at the school, I was at the back to school night and the school administrators were talking about, and they were receiving questions, and the school that Philip goes to is several buildings and students go from one building to another, just change classes and stuff. And just said, well, you know, where's the security here? I've noticed that you can just walk right in to the school without showing your ID. And the school's like, yeah, we're going to try to do something about that because we don't live in the times anymore where that was okay. And I'm thinking, here, everybody's accepting it as normal to live in fear, to live in a state of lockdown, to live where every door is monitored. If we were actually becoming healthier as a society, that wouldn't be true. We would feel I think real progress would be progress toward feeling at home here, feeling safe, feeling in our element. That would be a kind of wealth that whatever the GDP figures say, we're not seeing. Mm-hmm. So there is, and we could talk about health as well, like these ballyhooed life expectancy increases. I mean, they pretty much stalled out in the 70s and 80s. Most of the growth was in the first half of the 20th century. And now in the US, at least, the life expectancy is actually declining. So globally, it's still going up very slowly, but it's nothing like we were promised in the, I don't know how old you are. I think you're probably about my age, you know, growing up in the 70s. Mm-hmm. The year 2000 was this impossibly futuristic utopia. We were supposed to have 200-year lifespans and the end of all disease. And so there's a feeling, I think, of betrayal that we don't really believe anymore in the story that told us who we are and where we're going. And this is part of a identity crisis or a crisis in our meaning making.
I love that. And there's two things you're saying there is doubt and also self-trust. And they sort of intertwine with each other to a degree. And that doubt with the ID and the security and the doubt that, is there something wrong with my child? You know, everybody else seems to have a child that's allergic to something or is on some sort of medication, or an adult these days, you know, trying to find adults that are not on prescribed medication. So how does doubt play? Is it a destructive force? I'll give you my perception because I have a lot of people, and I was having a podcast a couple of days ago with somebody talking about gurus. We seem to nearly give away our self-trust to other authorities or other people to the point where we can't really even work out what to eat for ourselves or how to live. You know, we have to listen to these podcasts. We need to find these things to find out our core truths to a point, but even still, we feel like we need to give that away and be taught how to think and how to feel and what to eat. So how does doubt come in, and how do we cultivate this self-trust?
So I think doubt can be a very positive force, because it can be a sign that there's something that doesn't add up.
Mm-hmm.
If you're maybe in some career, for example, or a relationship, and everything you've been taught says, this is good, this is successful, this is the way life should be. But you have this unreasonable doubt, this protest that results in you not being able to fully commit to it, fully play along with it. That can be a good thing if, in fact, that career or that relationship does not meet who you want to become, who you are becoming. The doubt is a sign of a healthy spirit. And then on the flip side, there's the doubt that gives voice to, I would call it maybe the old story, when you are on a new path and experiencing yourself in an evolutionary way, then there are the voices that are saying you're crazy, you're irresponsible, you're naive, this will never work. So I can't simplify it to say doubt is a friend or doubt is an enemy. I wish it were that simple.
Mm. And then the self-trust, and then the courage to know which path to go on. How do we cultivate that, or how do you cultivate that or encourage people to?
Well, thinking about what you said about the guru, you know, and our abdicating of our own authority. On the other hand, I find that at a certain point in my evolution, I need somebody to give voice to what has been formless inside myself. And if somebody can speak to the unformed processes inside me and help bring them into form, it can be extremely helpful. For example, someone to say, oh, I recognize this situation. I see where you're at. You're in the liminal zone. You're in the space between stories. You're in the place where your old sense of self has fallen apart and you don't even know who you are anymore. And you don't know what's real. And you want to go back to that comforting old reality. And you feel like you're alone here. Well, I understand. I've been there. And there is a welcoming committee that is waiting for you as you step more fully into who you are becoming, that the reflection will gather around you. So and that's just one example that I speak to sometimes, that we are not separate individuals. That's the thing. We need each other. Now, of course, gurus have abused their positions, and more generally, the cult of the expert has been part of our disempowerment and the stripping away of our sovereignty. And we need to reclaim some of that. But that doesn't, the reclamation might mean stepping, I guess the successor to the age of the guru is the age of community. It's not the age of the individual fully self-sufficient and sovereign. It's the age of community where we source what we need from each other in a way that is not always hierarchical. It seems really abstract. I don't know if this is what you were asking about.
I'm loving it. Yeah, just flow, brother.
Yeah. Enlightenment is a group process. It's a collective process, not a heroic process.
So about courage then, I guess there's a lot of people out there that are living in this world currently that are disenchanted by it. If you do open up the mainstream news or the media, there's all of this doubt, there's all of this confusion, there's all of this fear, there's all of this impending doom that, whether it be financial, whether it be environmental or climate or whatever it may be, it feels so polarizing for so many people. So when you have that doubt and just step into that self-trust and find that community and learn from each other, what are the steps for this, as you call it, a collective enlightenment? And if you are an individual, what are the paths that you recommend or that you could see somebody taking?
The path, there's no general prescription that I could say, here's the most important thing you should be doing. Here's step one, step two, step three, because the concrete steps, they're unique to each person. And they come from experiencing ourselves as more than what we had been, or more than we had experienced ourselves. So For example, let me just give an example. One of the precepts of the story of separation, that's what I call the story that has dominated our society, the story of separation, the separate individual, the Newtonian universe, human separate from nature, and so on. The story of separation basically names your purpose as to pursue security, to make your way in the world, to make a living, it actually traces all the way back to Darwinian biology, to survive and reproduce, to outcompete the rest of all of those other separate individuals. So when we move to a story based on gift rather than competition that says, actually, you are here with a purpose that is part of reality, that was written into your life even before you were born, perhaps, or that is pregnant in the world, and that is what you were created for, just as in an ecosystem, every species is there for a reason. It's not superfluous. It plays an important role in the ecosystem, and without that species, the whole thing would be worse off. When we understand that that's true of ourselves too, it gives birth to totally different questions, and it allows us to see things we couldn't see before. So, for example, the question is, why am I here? How can I best serve? What is the gift that I carry that I'm yearning to express? And I will never rest and never feel fulfilled and content in my life until I find a way to express this. And the desire to express this drives me on a search. And that's okay. Therefore, my dissatisfaction and my impatience with a job where I'm not expressing my gifts, that is a good thing. That's not that I'm maladjusted. That is this yearning, this that is pushing me. That's my life force. So we can accept ourselves as that. And then what comes from that? What comes from that question? That's what's unique to each person. But the question itself reorients our perceptions. And it makes things that seemed kind of crazy in the old story into things that are totally normal. That would be an example of what I'm talking about. So I guess if you wanted to say step one would simply be to attend to the part of you that resonates with what I've said, the part of you that knows that that's true. And from that attention and the recognition of that truth, see what is born.
I love it. It's a question. I have these questions every single day, usually. So what am I doing? You know, and through my own, I guess, self-analysis and meditation and interviewing people like yourselves and scouring through books and going on different personal journeys of discovery. I won't say I've boiled it down or I've got it to one particular thing, but I think in essence, it's for us to grow and share ourselves and express ourselves creatively. And also when we do grow, there's also the other side of remembrance of who we are. It's nearly this paradox where we grow, but we remember at the same time. It's like we're moving forward, but we're also looking back to understand. It's this beautiful balance. And at the core of that is, as human beings, it's for us to express our unique gifts, whatever they may be, you know, and it doesn't have to be singular. It can be a multitude of things on any single day, on every single moment, and that can evolve through time. And I'd love to be able to explore this with you about how some people think it is a singular purpose, or is it a multitude, and how can it evolve, and should it evolve, and collectively, how do we evolve this together?
Yeah, it doesn't have to be something that looks to the outside world as a grand purpose. You might not ever be able to define it or describe it sufficiently in words. And it could be something that's very humble or that looks humble from the outside, but in your inner landscape, it looms with dominating importance. You know that this is what I'm here to do, even if it is never recognized or applauded by the audience of your life, but you sense an invisible audience that is applauding it. So yeah, it might look like something big in the world, a mission to change the world. In fact, everybody is on a mission to change the world. It's just that we do not understand how the world changes. And in fact, the things that might look the most important and the people who might look the most important are no more important than anybody else, because the world doesn't work as we've been taught. And the actions that seem the most inconsequential sometimes are the most powerful of all.
I love that. It's about that no separation.
Yeah. Yeah, especially on a 500-year timescale. You don't know that maybe, yeah, you know, like I've been, we made friends with some people here who have a foster child, and these are talented people, you know, who could, the amount of time it takes to raise this foster child who came from a very horrifying background, the amount of time that they're devoting to this is enormous. I mean, they don't, you know, forget about crusading for climate change or against climate change, or forget about doing some big world-saving thing. I mean, all of their energy is devoted toward this young being. So from the conventional perspective, they're not doing anything to change the world. Not compared to, I don't know, Bill McKibben or Al Gore or somebody who's doing, I heard one climate activist, well-known climate activist, say to an audience, say, "You are doing the most important thing that any humans have ever done on Earth." And I'm like, really? Do you know that? Do you know that these people are doing something more important than these humble people taking care of a child? Do you really know that? And if you think you know that, what set of assumptions is that coming from? What set of assumptions about how the world works is that coming from? And if you excavate that, you find that it's coming from a set of assumptions that are pretty much the same assumptions that are generating the ecological destruction that we're seeing today. That the world is this thing outside of ourselves, governed by mathematical forces, and therefore that if you want to change the world, you have to muster a lot of force under your command to counteract the other forces out there. And therefore, change becomes a kind of a crusade or a war, which is really what a crusade is, a holy war. And then, so those who are doing these humble acts of care and love, they're not actually changing very much. What does it matter if they raise this child in a beautiful way instead of him being abused, if sea levels are going to rise 50 feet or whatever they say is going to happen? Like, that kind of logic is a logic of separation. A logic of interbeing understands that every act has cosmic significance, and that maybe, to use the logic of morphic resonance, that they're deep and in external ways thankless. They don't get applauded. They don't get told that they're saving the world, and they don't get a lot of money. But these acts of kindness generate a field of kindness. These acts of courage, these acts of generosity, they generate a field of these things that affects the world in ways that scientific materialism does not understand.
I actually had the word written down here, which was kindness, and it nearly feels like it's one of the first steps to what you're talking about, this beautiful story and the act of kindness to be able to participate and share that with ourselves. And kindness to ourselves. And one of the interesting things that's been in my radar lately is to treat yourself as if you're a child and be kind to yourself in all aspects of your evolution as a human being. And that will resonate through every single part of what you do throughout the day. Or at least you'll realize when you're not being kind to yourself and to others and to the planet. And I would love for you to just extrapolate a little bit more about that kindness concept in how you teach people.
Well, it brings up the question, where does kindness come from?
Mm-hmm.
One of the patterns, one of the habits that we have inherited from the story of separation is that any virtue that we elevate, the next step becomes, okay, I'm going to achieve that. I'm going to strive for that. I'm going to conquer whatever is in the way to achieve this thing, I want to be a kind person. There's a kind of an ambition that is habitual. And so I like to ask instead of reenacting that template of here's another thing you're supposed to do, here's another virtue you're supposed to attain, kindness, generosity, integrity, being a person of your word, courage, humility, especially humility is not something you can attain as a goal. So the question then comes up for me always, what is the field from which kindness grows? What is the field from which generosity grows? Where does compassion come from? Where does courage come from? These are serious questions. If you're really serious about wanting to live in a world governed by kindness, then you have to ask that. And you have to ask also, well, why do I want to be kind? What's in it for me? Like, what if you seriously ask that? Why should I be kind? Is there an answer to that? So where I take that, kindness is a result of a way of perceiving the world accurately. Because when we are seeing people for who they truly are and able to perceive their beauty, their divinity, their lovableness, then kindness is totally natural. And if we are unkind, it's a symptom that something is getting in the way of that. It could be a way that we're in pain. If I'm in pain, it's much harder to be kind because I'm not in the living ongoing perception of somebody's beauty or divinity. Or it could be that a judgment is getting in the way, something that I'm projecting or teaching about human nature or conditioning from my social circumstances that prevents me from seeing people as they truly are. And that doesn't mean that I'm ignoring their uglier parts or their vicious parts, their brutal, violent parts, but it's to understand where those come from too. And I think, what would the world be like if we were able to see everybody the same way a mother sees her child?
Mm.
And anybody you look at that with hatred or resentment or contempt or disgust, what are you not seeing that their mother can see? If there's something you're not seeing, you're not in reality. You're in a delusion. And whatever judgment you have is based on an incomplete data set. So I guess what I like to do is I like to say things and put ideas out there, put stories out there, and put a frequency out there that suggests to people, look at this thing. See, help me, to create a common seeing of what a mother sees in her child. The more that perception spreads, the more beautiful the world will be that we live in.
Mm. It's so timely. Just a few days ago, I actually shared an image that my wife took of this native bird that we have here in Australia, and it's an ibis. It's generally known in this country as the bin turkey or the bin chicken. It's one of these birds that have adapted to our encroachment on their habitat and now lives, I guess, symbiotically with us in our cities, and you'll find them everywhere. And people are disgusted by these birds. And it's funny, like over the last 10 years, whenever I see them, it's usually in a time of reflection or a time of great creative perception for me. It's like, oh, I'm on the right path because I'm thinking this thought and I've just seen the ibis, you know, it's just entered my sphere. It's either flown across or walked in front of my path when I'm thinking about one of the things that's important to me in my life. And I shared this photo and I actually Googled, you know, spirit animal and what does this bird mean? And probably about 10% of people that commented said, you know, Peter, I feel the same way whenever I see this bird. You know, there's something in me that gets triggered in a positive way. Whereas 90% of the people that commented, they just couldn't understand how I could share such a common creature that is regarded in our community as something quite dirty and undesirable. And my intention was just to show my appreciation, you know, nearly like, I've learned to appreciate this bird, and I wonder what that could mean for other aspects of our lives. Just like you're saying, can you see through a mother's eyes of her baby? And imagine if we saw everybody with that lens, I'm not sure where I'm going with this, but I did want to ask you this because it seems to be quite prevalent at the moment, whether it's climate change deniers or our extinction. We've also got the vegan movement, which is, you know, quite aggressive against people that are eating meat. Then you've got the carnivore side of things or the omnivore side of things. And there seems to be this real division that's out there at the moment. It nearly seems to be getting played out by the media, by our energetic field, that there has to be this sort of division. And I've listened to a few of your talks about climate, and I'd love for you to be able to explain your perception around what's going on with the environment, because it gives us a different lens in which to look at this through.
Yeah. Well, you've just named two of my favorite issues to talk about. One of them is climate and one of them is polarization. I think that the polarization of society is the meta issue, which is, if it is not solved, then nothing is going to change. Mm-hmm. Because we are incinerating 99% of our energy fighting each other. Where then can come the coherency that is necessary to change the course of the Titanic? We need unity to do that. So if you are interested in maintaining the status quo, the best strategy is to divide the public around polarizing issues, and they will spend all of their time fighting each other and not seeing what the tempest hides. So they fight, they generate these pyrotechnics, you know, this spectacle. And underneath that, the ship continues sailing and towards the iceberg. So facing any polarizing issue, I like to look, okay, what are both sides taking for granted? What shared assumptions do they have that might not even be true? What questions is neither side asking? Where is the common ground? Like, so for example, with vegans and paleo types, I mean, really, they are at least large sectors of both of those camps, which is a military metaphor, and an appropriate one. Large sectors of both sides, both of those camps actually agree on an awful lot. Mm-hmm. They're both against industrial agriculture, for example, which is 99% of agriculture in the developed world. So they should pretty much agree on 99% of
that
policy.
Issue.
Yeah, right. Mm. So, but instead, they focus on the parts where they disagree. And it feels very important to establish that I'm right and they're wrong. We're right and they're wrong. Where does that come from? Why is it so important to be right? It is a way to identify yourself as part of a group and to validate yourself as a good person. And symptomatic of that is the diagnosis of the other side as, well, obviously, they must be either stupid or immoral or ignorant. One of those things. Because if they were rational and good and smart like me, then they would obviously agree with me. So if that is the way that you're organizing the world into us and them, you are going to be impervious to any evidence that contradicts your position, because it's not just an intellectual violation. It is a violation of your very sense of self and your sense of belonging. And so that sets up a situation where neither side can possibly change. So I see this in climate as well. It's each side is living in an entirely separate reality that can accommodate and interpret any fact, any data point that comes in can be interpreted in a way that fits their own story. So I think actually both sides are missing a lot of the big picture. And what I think the big picture is, I call it the living Earth paradigm, which basically says that the planet is alive. And this might sound, I don't know, Pete, I don't know like how, you know,
we're open, mate. Go for it.
All right. Because, you know, I know you have a lot of followers and it's probably a pretty broad cross section. So some of what I say might sound unscientific, but I can clothe each of these points in very sound science, ecological science, systems theory, and so forth. Okay. But I'm just going to say it the way I like to say it, which is Earth is alive. Its organs are things like soil, water, the species, the whales, the fish, the forests, the wetlands. These are organs of a living being, each one of them contributing indispensable things to the well-being of the entirety, just like your body. Mm-hmm. Life creates the conditions for life. Therefore, even if we cut emissions to zero, if we continue to degrade and destroy the soil, clear-cut the forests, dig up the mountains, poison the entire planet with pesticides, kill the fish, kill the whales. We're not doing a lot of direct whaling anymore, but things like seismic surveys and Navy sonar and all kinds of stuff there, and just PCBs, the pollution, the toxic pollution, et cetera, et cetera. If we keep doing that, the planet will die of organ failure. So I think that the whole focus on the main question is global warming happening, how fast, and the focus then on cutting greenhouse gas emissions. That is such a narrow piece of the whole big picture. And in fact, if we pursued the policies that come from the living earth paradigm, which is to first protect any pristine ecosystem and then to restore, to regenerate what's been damaged. If we did that, then carbon wouldn't be an issue either, because first we would be uptaking and sequestering way, way, way more carbon than we are now. And secondly, because if you hold all of these places as precious and sacred, then you're not going to do mountaintop removal anymore. You're not going to do fracking. You're not going to do oil drilling. You're not going to build pipelines. Even if you don't care about carbon, you're still not going to do these things because of how ecologically destructive they are. So basically, the whole debate, the whole polarizing debate, is totally unnecessary. Now, maybe I'm overstating the case a little bit, but if we can look for the common ground of we love this planet and the beings thereof, and we orient toward that, then we don't even need to spend all of our energy trying to convince the other side of something that is actually not necessary to convince them of.
I love it. And another two words that I wrote down were authentic self. And we're talking about the authentic self of planet Earth and also the authentic self of ourselves, because we seem to be harming ourselves in the same way that we seem to be harming the planet by our thoughts, by our daily actions, whether it be our diet, whether it be the medication, whether it be self-limiting beliefs and stifling now our precious gifts, very much like we're doing to the planet as well. So thank you for that explanation. That deeply resonated with me. So do we have a solution?
Yeah, well, the problem is a symptom of everything. So the solution is everything. You kind of said it. I can't remember exactly what you said, but the way I put it is that the planetary climate is inseparable from the social climate, the economic climate, the psychic climate, if you will. And that therefore, like, it's not ecological destruction isn't just happening. It's happening because of humanity and how we are being right now in the world. So any healing on any level is going to be part of planetary healing. Therefore, any way that you are expressing your gift in service to life, and this touches into what I said, life creates the conditions for life. Therefore, your purpose is to express your gift in service to life and to make this planet more and more and more alive, and really on some cosmic scale to make the universe more and more and more alive. So any enactment of that purpose is going to create a healed planet, because the healing comes from us, where we are intimate participants in the healing.
I love it. I interviewed an Australian fellow who's got a movie coming out called The Portal, and it's about the power of meditation. And the team's goal is to get 1 billion people meditating every day. And it was interesting that this morning over a cup of tea with my wife, we sit in silence and have a meditation. And before this podcast, a thing popped up into my mind. It was like, well, isn't prayer the same, could be considered as meditation? And with so many people, last count, I'm aware of 95% of the world's population are religious in some aspect. Can the intention of meditation or the intention of prayer help us along this journey for this more beautiful story?
I mean, in a word, yes. Meditation is certainly a healing path and a path of unfolding more fully into who we are truly, who we truly are and why we're here. Prayer is a way of aligning ourselves with an intention. It's a way of making ourselves available. When prayer is done with that understanding, with the understanding that this is not just a magical incantation that says, pray that all beings are happy, but don't make me do anything about it. You know, or pray that, let's pray for the refugees, but I certainly don't want them in my backyard. Or let's pray for the poor, but I'm not going to do anything to help the poor. Prayer is supposed to be a declaration of a willingness to participate in the thing that you pray for. So when it's done with that willingness, then it becomes very powerful and it gives birth to opportunities to align action with what is stated in the prayer. But if it's misunderstood as some kind of magic formula and God is just going to do it, then I think that it actually radiates out a vibration of passivity and is not helpful.
I got two more questions for you. Actually, one question, and I'd love for you to be able to read something for me. But the first question is, you have children of your own, and I do too, 13 and 14-year-old daughters. I sometimes ask my guests to have a think about what they would say to their own 13 or 14-year-old self or younger self, especially at this point in time in our evolution where we have so many, I guess, opportunities or distractions or influences, and especially when it comes to education, because there seems to be a hell of a lot of expectation for our children to succeed in the academic pursuit of excellence. What are some words of encouragement or understanding? Understanding is probably a better way for these children that are trying to work out where they're going to go in their life, what it all means, and what path to take, and especially if kids aren't doing well at school in that system.
Yeah, I mean, it really depends. What I say depends on the specific interaction. But one message that can be useful sometimes is that your secret knowledge is true, that you're here to do a great service. It may not look great, but your feeling of being born for a purpose, a beautiful purpose, is accurate. And that it is okay to trust yourself, even to trust yourself to make mistakes that you learn from. And if you hate school, if you can't make yourself go along with the program, that might not mean that you've got a problem. It might mean that the program has got a problem and that it is your strength of spirit that is making you not participate in it. Maybe it's because it's not worthy of your participation, but that doesn't mean that life itself is unworthy of your participation. That just means that the program offered to you may not be worthy of it, but lurking within it and outside it, there is something worthy. And that thing is available to you in any circumstance. Even if it is an oppressive circumstance like school, you can still be a carrier of humor, of kindness, of compassion. And that's not to say just put up with it, but it is to say, stay strong. You don't need to be in despair thinking that you've been placed somewhere where you can do no good. You can always live from your sense of purpose and wanting to create life and then be aware of opportunities to change those circumstances. Because the more that you embrace the true knowledge that you're here to render beautiful service to the world, the more opportunities will become visible for you to act on that.
I love it, brother. Thank you so much. And I'd love to finish off with, if you're up for it, my favorite passage from one of your books is The Gathering of the Tribe. It goes for a few minutes, but I think it would help bring everything that we've spoken about in this podcast into some sort of tangible understanding. Well, it definitely did for me. I had tears in my eyes when I read it the first time. I was like, fuck, okay, you're speaking to me and this makes so much sense. And I feel like that will resonate so deeply for so many of our listeners.
Okay. The Gathering of the Tribe. Once upon a time, a great tribe of people lived in a world far away from ours. Whether far away in space or in time, or even outside of time, we do not know. They lived in a state of enchantment and joy that few of us today dare to believe could exist, except in those exceptional peak experiences when we glimpse the true potential of life and mind. One day, the elders of the tribe called a meeting. They gathered around, and one of them spoke very solemnly. "My friends," she said, "there is a world that needs our help. It is called Earth, and its fate hangs in the balance. Its humans have reached a critical point in their collective birthing, the same point our own planet was at 1 million years ago, and they will be stillborn without our help. Who would like to volunteer for a mission to this time and place and render service to humanity?" "Tell us more about this mission," they asked. "It is no small thing. Our shaman will put you into a deep, deep trance, so complete that you will forget who you are. You will live a human life, and in the beginning, you will completely forget your origins. You will forget even our language and your own true name. You will be separated from the wonder and beauty of our world and from the love that bathes us all. You will miss it deeply, yet you will be unable to name what you are missing. You will remember the love and beauty that we know to be normal only as a longing in your heart. Your memory will take the form of an intuitive knowledge as you plunge into the painfully marred earth that a more beautiful world is possible. As you grow up in that world, your knowledge will be under constant assault. You will be told in a million ways that a world of destruction, violence, drudgery, anxiety, and degradation is normal. You may go through a time when you are completely alone, with no allies to affirm your knowledge of a more beautiful world. You may plunge into a depth of despair that we in our world of light cannot imagine. But no matter what, a spark of knowledge will never leave you. A memory of your true origin will be encoded in your DNA. That spark will lie within you, inextinguishable, until one day it is awakened. You see, even though you will feel for a time utterly alone, you will not be alone. We will send you assistance, help that you will experience as miraculous, experiences that you will describe as transcendent. They will fan that spark into a flame. For a few moments or hours or days, you will reawaken to the beauty and the joy that is meant to be. You will see it on Earth, for even though the planet and its people are deeply wounded, there is beauty there still, projected from past and future onto the present as a promise of what is possible and a reminder of what is real. After that glimpse, the flame may die down into an ember again as the routines of normal life there swallow you up. But after each awakening, they will seem less normal, and the story of that world will seem less real. The ember will glow brighter. When enough embers do that, they will all burst into flame together and sustain each other. Because remember, you will not be there alone. As you begin to awaken to your mission, you will meet others of your tribe. You will recognize them by your common purpose, values, and intuitions, and by the similarity of the paths that you have walked. As the condition of the planet Earth reaches crisis proportions, your paths will cross more and more. The time of loneliness, the time of thinking you might be crazy, will be over. You will find the people of your tribe all over the Earth and become aware of them through the long-distance communication technologies used on that planet. But the real shift, the real quickening, will happen in face-to-face gatherings in special places. When many of you gather together, you will launch a new stage on your journey, a journey that, I assure you, will end where it begins right now. Then the mission that lay unconscious within you will flower into consciousness. Your intuitive rebellion against the world presented to you as normal will become an explicit quest to create a more beautiful one. A woman said, "Tell us more about the time of loneliness, that we might prepare for it." The elder said, "In the time of loneliness, you will always be seeking to reassure yourself that you are not crazy. You will do that by telling people all about what is wrong with the world, and you will feel a sense of betrayal when they don't listen to you. You might hunger for stories of wrongness, atrocity, and ecological destruction, all of which confirm the validity of your intuition that a more beautiful world exists. But after you have fully received the help that we will send you and the quickening of your gatherings, you will no longer need to do that, because you will know Your energy will therefore turn toward actively creating that more beautiful world. The tribeswoman asked, "How do you know that this will work? Are you sure our shaman's powers are great enough to send us on such a journey?" The elder replied, "I know it will work because he has done it many times before. Many have already been sent to Earth to live human lives and to lay the groundwork for the mission that you will undertake now. He's been practicing. The only difference now is that many of you will venture there at once. What is new in the time you will live in is that you will gather in critical mass and each awaken the other to your mission. The heat you will generate will kindle the same spark that lies in every human being, for in truth, each one is from a tribe like ours. The whole galaxy and beyond is converging on Earth, for never before has a planet journeyed so far into separation and made it back again. Those of you who go will be part of a new step in cosmic evolution." A tribesman asked, "Is there a danger we will become lost in that world and never wake up from the shamanic trance? Is there a danger that the despair, the cynicism, the pain of separation will be so great that it will extinguish the spark of hope, the spark of our true selves and origin, and that we will be separated from our beloved ones forever?" The elder replied, "That is impossible. The more deeply you get lost, the more powerful the help we will send you. You might experience it at the time as a collapse of your personal world, the loss of everything important to you. Later, you will recognize the gift within it. We will never abandon you." Another man asked, "Is it possible that our mission will fail and that this planet Earth will perish?" The elder replied, "I will answer your question with a paradox. It is impossible that your mission will fail. Yet, its success hangs on your own actions. The fate of the world is in your hands. The key to this paradox lies within you, in the feeling you carry that each of your actions, even your personal secret struggles, has cosmic significance. You will know then, as you know now, that everything you do matters." There were no more questions. The volunteers gathered in a circle, and the shaman went to each one. The last thing each was aware of was the shaman blowing smoke in his or her face. They entered a deep trance and dreamed themselves into the world where we find ourselves today.
Oh, that was more powerful when you read it. I've got tears crying.
Yeah, it has the ring of truth, doesn't it?
Mm-hmm. I love you, brother. Thank you so much for your time on the podcast today. And I cannot wait to meet you in person one day. Thank you so much.
Yes, thank you, Pete. I enjoyed it very much myself.
The information, views, and opinions expressed in this podcast should not be treated as a substitute for nutritional, medical, or other advice by a qualified professional. Guests in this podcast express their own opinions, experiences, and conclusions. Nothing in this podcast should be used to diagnose, treat, cure, or prevent any medical condition. Neither Pete Evans nor any sponsor endorse any views, opinions, or conclusions expressed or shared in this podcast.